Welcome to the Open Hearted Podcast. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Open Hearted Podcast. I'm your host, Will Wheeler, joined with my main man, Photon John. Kev, what's going on, brother?
Monday being Monday.
Long time no see, right?
Yeah. Was it? Yeah, 3 days.
3 days, Friday. So for all of our listeners, we've sort of had to bunch up a few just due to timing and stuff like that. So we sort of did one on Friday, which was cool. I quite enjoyed that, and yeah, now we're doing one today. How was your weekend anyway, brother?
Pretty cruisy. Just went to a friend's birthday and a gig and whatnot. How about you?
Pretty good, man. Football grand finals. Brisbane's into all the grand finals. So we got the AFL and the NRL for the Australians listening here. People overseas are probably thinking, what the hell are these two people talking about? Formula One was good.
The birthday was at Moo Moo's Bar and Grill, and they had both games on like every second TV.
Cool.
It was absolutely cool.
And the Formula One was cool as well. So it was because it was in Japan, it was in the same time zone as us, and the Australian came third. So that was really good. So, yeah, it was a good weekend. I can't complain. But I'll tell you what, we should get stuck into this. We've got a really cool guest joining us today and really cool topic to be talking about as well. So what we're going to be covering today is neuroinclusion, creating safe and brave spaces in technology with Georgina Shute. So let's get Georgina up on the stage. Georgina, how are you today?
Good. Hi, folks. Nice to meet you.
Hey, Georgina.
Not a problem. All the way from Glasgow. Where are you at? Sorry, somewhere in Scotland.
Falkirk.
So if anyone's listening from Falkirk, big shout out. I don't know. I don't really know anyone from there. I probably do, but not sure. How you been anyway? Thank you so much for joining us.
Good. Thank you so much for having me.
Not a problem. So, you know, before you came on, you're talking about you just did a drawing course, right?
Yeah, I just learned to draw. So when I was at school, I used to really like drawing, and then adult life got in the way, and I got a job when I was 17. I've been working ever since. Then I was like, oh, maybe I should try and find something in my life that isn't work. Picked up a pencil and have been, spent a week drawing.
Yeah, nice. You know, I think the biggest thing, especially as being an ADHDer, sometimes having something beyond, say, your business and all that can sometimes be a really good thing to do, if you get my drift. It sort of takes you away from your mind sometimes, or you can focus on something different. Do you find that with yourself?
Yeah, definitely trying to find things to get into that flow state that doesn't require me to look at my phone, because if I'm forever mining dopamine, I'm forever trying to find things to excite my brain. And I found with drawing, I can focus on it for hours, and I've been like, oh, it's been 6 hours and my legs hurt, I need to get up.
Yes, that is such a good point. I think sometimes phones for ADHDers could have been, it's like the worst drug possible for us, you know what I mean? But anyway, we should get stuck into this. But before we do, let's just do a bit of a shout out for anyone who's listening or hasn't listened to us before. If you haven't listened to us before, please check us out on, or please follow, subscribe, and like to our TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, X, which used to be Twitter, Twitch, YouTube, and we're currently live on, we're actually live on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn at the moment. But if you also haven't checked us out before, please go to the openheartedsociety.com website there where you can check out past and, I suppose, upcoming podcasts that are happening, and please subscribe to our email. So let's get stuck into this. So Georgina, please, you know, we've been dying. you've been reaching out to me, so excited to come on. Please tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your backstory? Like, who are you? Well,
what a big question for me on a Monday morning.
Tell us about it.
So I believe that nobody should feel different, feel like a failure for being different. I spent my whole life feeling like I was a failure. My high school teacher told me I do nothing with my life. And here I am today telling myself and anybody who's listening today that it does get better and that those defining moments don't have to define you. They can define you in positive ways. So it's led me on a journey of self-discovery and empowering myself and other neurodivergents along the way. I've worked in technology for the last 10 years and led multiple digital transformations for some of the UK's biggest brands, and mainly focusing on psychological safety. So the belief that when you're in a team, you feel safe to be yourself, you feel safe to ask questions, and you feel safe to challenge one another.
Sorry to cut in on there. And I like that you're speaking about psychological safety right here, right? Because with Neurodiversity Academy, my other business, we've actually been redefining our values. And one of the values that we actually have implemented is safety. And it's exactly that. You know, I think people do need to feel that they can be themselves within any type of working environment. And if they do have something that they want to share, make people feel comfortable in saying that. Do you know what I mean? Because what's been some of your experiences, say, not working in one of those, because I'm assuming you've probably worked in some of those workplaces where psychological safety just wasn't a thing.
Yeah, and I think also psychological safety isn't an unsurmountable thing, and I think it's a really fair thing to need with the people that you're working with. I want to feel like I can have a conversation with you, and I want to feel like you're not going to negatively challenge me when I say something that may be a difficult subject, because we're adults trying to do the best thing we possibly can with the information that we have, and it's not always possible. In previous work environments, I've been screamed at in offices because I've incorrectly written emails. I've made decisions about things that weren't up to scratch with a senior level of management. And therefore, again, I've been screamed at in offices. I'm a really emotional person, and I don't think it's acceptable to scream at anybody. But for me, really, really hard. And in those situations, I can get so overwhelmed. And this is right at the, like when I was figuring out whether or not, like, what ADHD was. So it was a whole cluster of, oof, how do I deal with this? And what I've done is taken those experiences and gone, it doesn't have to be like that. It really doesn't.
The reason why I was going to step in there was, it was interesting that you're talking about people screaming at you and stuff like that. And I think that sometimes people don't realize what screaming at one person, what the bigger picture can look like. Now, I know a lot of neurodivergent people, and I've heard stories before where people have seen a manager or whatever that is screaming at them or screaming at someone else who wasn't them. They hadn't done anything wrong, the person who was viewing this, but they almost felt the fear of just watching that, and they've quit jobs because they're like, I'm afraid that's going to happen to me, and I just don't want that to happen to me. Do you know what I mean? And this is where it's like, you just don't see the damage you're doing by creating that environment, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's like a mirror, right? Like, you look into a mirror and it's perfect. It may be a little bit smudgy, but as soon as you break it, you can never put it back together in exactly the same way. There's an art form where you can, you know, you can put gold in between the creases or whatever it's called, the broken bits, and put it back together, but it's still broken. And once that trust is broken with the people that you work with, then it takes a really long time to bring that back. And screaming is one, one big example of what could happen, but a lot of these things can be microaggressions within the workplace that people don't know are happening. So redefining what safety means in your organization. Sometimes those conversations are on a one-on-one basis because people come to your organization probably with baggage from somewhere else. And so to understand how people work on a one-on-one basis will then help you figure out in a team perspective how people do best work. Sometimes people don't want to say, someone screamed at me in an office once and I cried and it was absolutely horrendous, because that may have a massive impact on what they're, what people are going to think of them in an organization. And that shouldn't be the case.
Another example I can think of is, growing up, my mum was very big on making sure I understood that that wasn't acceptable to say in school. I got a couple of teachers that would yell at people and stuff. And she would come up and give them what for, and they'd, you know, move on or have to do sensitivity training or something along those lines. And so I took that into adulthood, but I guess it's another angle from which this is broken. It meant that I left a lot of jobs because I could just see this behavior in a lot of places. And I was just like, okay, well, this is not the place that I want to be. And it was really hard to find a place that didn't have that.
Hey, sorry, can I just step in? Hey, for any of our listeners, if you can hear a cat in the background, Kevin's looking after a cat at the moment. And whenever we're on the podcast, she likes to, maybe she wants attention, mate. Maybe she's trying to get on the podcast, you know what I mean? But all cool. Yeah. Georgina, so, you know, before, I think a big reason why you're coming on here is, you know, you said that, you know, you've started some stuff around this area, probably making people more aware about these certain situations. Tell us a little bit about your work.
Yeah, so I coach clients and deliver workshops all over the world, remotely and in person. And it's around embracing difference to create the incredible. And what I mean by that is once we understand how incredible human beings are on their own and then together, we can start creating the most incredible things, and especially in the technology world, when we're solving problems that didn't exist 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 2 years ago, in order to solve those problems, having different types of thought processes in your team, in your organization makes a massive difference. But to do that, you also need to support the people that are in your organization, and psychological safety for me is a cornerstone of that. And going back to one of the things you were saying, some people just don't know. And so it's partially an education piece, so a discovery around pinpointing what people's challenges are and what their needs are, and then tailoring community to an organization, whether or not it's neurodiversity, whether or not it's specifically around certain conditions, so ADHD networks or those kind of things, so people can understand more about what ADHD means to them. I'm also an ADHD coach separately, so I coach people on a one-on-one basis over 6 and 12 week programs to understand that we are enough as ADHD is, and actually understand that having strategies around us make it easier. But in order to do that, organizations need to be safe places to support their colleagues.
Okay. Sorry, can I say something on that? Right. And I totally agree. And this has been the hard part, I think. Like, I often get people calling me up saying, hey, Will, we've got this person, they're really struggling. All of that. And it's like, okay, that's good, but I can only do so much. I can't just help this person. I can give this person strategies, but what's happening in the environment? Do you know what I mean? And 9 times out of 10, I'm usually hearing that there's a boss who hates this person or isn't getting it, isn't working in. And I'm like, well, look, you guys can keep paying me all this money to come in and try and create change, but you're not going to get change until the environment changes and your management have a bit of a better understanding of what is required in these situations, if you get my drift.
Yep. And also knowing that making these changes actually leads to better results. So the safer someone feels, I don't know how much it costs in Australia, but in the UK, it costs about 15% of a person's salary to rehire them, let alone if that person's integral to an organization, they've been there a long time and they take all their friends with them. So from one person, I don't know, 1 times 5, that's 5 times 15%. You know, it's a lot of money to go back to basics and to support your staff.
And I think as well, like one of the biggest things that I've actually spoken about in the past is that when we're talking, I think with neuroinclusion or neurodiversity within workplaces in itself, it's not, it doesn't have to be a huge money spending process, if that makes sense. I think when I first got into neurodiversity and understanding all of it and all that, people, I'd be seeing like places like talking about changing the light bulbs and spending all this money and all of this. And I'm thinking, that can help totally, but there's probably some basic sort of things to at least start from, if that makes sense, rather than going, hey, look, let's spend millions or hundreds of thousands of dollars on something to really create this environment where it could be, you know, I think it's as simple as, like you were talking about before, community. Do you know what I mean? Having an understanding about what community is, how to start something within those organizations and so forth.
Yeah, and I think these things they can be really small, and also understanding what people need from an organization is, for me, the best place to start, because you can, like you said, you can spend thousands of dollars, thousands of pounds, but you haven't fixed anything. You've probably made it worse because you haven't asked anybody. And when you're building products, whatever those things are, if you haven't asked the person that's going to use them, have you ever used a website and you've gone, why is this so hard to use? Why can't I get from A to B? Because 9 times out of 10, the person that built that website had an idea in their mind of what that thing should be, and they didn't ask the person using the website. This is a really similar thing. If you don't ask the people that work with you, don't ask your colleagues what they need. And I guess it's a double-edged sword, because sometimes they don't know, but being able to have managers that can ask the right questions to understand what their colleagues need is fundamental, I think.
Well, you know, and also too, like from past experience, I've sort of gone into certain situations, and I suppose this is what made me go into this area, is I would be very open about my neurodiversity and all of that type of stuff, and they just didn't know how to support me. Do you know what I mean? And that was when the penny dropped, right? And it's sort of like, oh my God, these people. It's not that I don't think people are. What's what I'm looking for? People are deliberately going out there trying to make your life difficult, but. When you don't have any understanding or training on that, how are these people supposed to really do anything, if that makes sense, or support you in a way to be able to grow and develop, if that makes sense?
Yeah, but people generally...
Sorry, you go.
No, it's fine.
I think, you know, it's something that needs to be acknowledged, I think, is that sometimes ADHD can cause you to behave in ways that, if that person doesn't understand ADHD, can seem quite frustrating to them. And of course, unfortunate interactions that way.
Yeah. And also, I think there are some people, but most people aren't actively trying to be difficult or bad. And so to acknowledge that, like, oh, why is that person reacting in that way? How, I don't know, what can I do? If that person knows they can support you, if not, we're on a journey together. How do we figure this out? Because we're here to build whatever it is in a technology company, for example. We're here to build cool things. We need to feel like we want to be here. Like we're at work for a really long time. And to be able to make environments safe for people, you know, makes it hopefully a bit easier.
Well, yeah. And I think as well, like, I know for me personally, right, I'm very big, say like leadership, for example, right? Or people wanting to build on their careers. I'm very big on trying to help people, you know, not necessarily stay with our company for the rest of their life. If they want to, they can. That's great. But if I'm able to help someone develop and grow and then go out there and build something themselves and become a great success in that, to me, I've done my job properly, because I've been able to help support that person to become something really great, which maybe if they're neurodivergent, you were speaking about in school, how you were told that, you know, you'll never be nothing. I'm sure Kevin and myself, I know I definitely heard that type of stuff in my head. And probably nearly every neurodivergent person has gone through something similar.
Oh, if he just applied himself.
Yeah.
If only you just focus a bit more.
If only you would just do the one thing that you have trouble doing, then you could be great.
Are you guys sure you didn't have my report card?
Maybe we can swap notes after.
Yeah. Probably could be the same thing anyway.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. We are going into these workplaces with baggage. And I hate to say it, we are, right? It's almost like with... you know, with Neurodiversity Academy, we're doing a lot of stuff in tertiary education. And this is the big thing I'm talking to people about is, yeah, these people are coming from school, now going into higher education, and then they're getting hit with all the exact same stuff again. And I think as well, sometimes I sometimes feel that people think that once you finish school, you don't have dyslexia or ADHD or autism anymore. You're just like normal, and then you get to work type of thing, but it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, well, they're like, well, you got through school, so clearly you can just apply yourself like everyone else now.
Totally.
And also the school structures they're built to create that sense of structure and routine for people. And when you go into the workplace, that doesn't always exist in the same way. Like there are so many unwritten rules in an office environment that, I don't know, top practical tip for managers, create an office set of rules that people can look at and go, oh, okay, you know, I don't know, everybody gets into work 5 minutes early because they like to have a chat and they like to have a coffee, whatever those things are. If you don't know those things exist, and then you can, I don't know, be like, why is everybody doing that? I don't know. Everybody eats lunch at a specific time. And I'm like, but I don't want to. And then you kind of feel left out and excluded. But if you know what those rules are, you can then adapt to them and work with them or change them.
See, it's really interesting. Since I've been diagnosed with, say, my ADHD, because I've been diagnosed with dyslexia for, over 20 years or probably 30 years now. I can't even remember. But I've only just been recently diagnosed with ADHD. But now I've been diagnosed with it, it's starting to make sense why I would struggle with certain things within the workplace. So an open working environment, man, no wonder I would find it hard to concentrate because everyone's talking. People would take the desk that I'm normally sitting at. Do you know what I mean? Little things like that. But now I've got that understanding, it's a lot better. But if my employers understood that as well, maybe they would have been able to better accommodate me in the same time as well, instead of me leaving there quite pissed off and, you know, not being very productive at all, if that makes sense.
Totally.
And I think also a lot of these company rules or any social structure was created by someone, therefore there is an opportunity to change it. Like all rules and regulations were created for a purpose. It doesn't necessarily mean that the purpose is fit for purpose now because we've evolved and we've changed.
Well, I think, you know, personally, and I always say this, and I know it just depends on the person, but for me, the pandemic was probably the best thing for me because I've learned that I'm able to work from home a lot more now. But in saying that, with my, you know, I thrive off social interaction. I do need to be around people sometimes. So being at home all the time isn't the best, but I've now learned that I work so much better when I'm not in the office, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Like having a bit of balance in our lives.
Yeah, totally. Because a lot of the time I'm finding now, sometimes when I'm working from home, I'm getting so much more done that I've got everything done before the end of the week. So it's giving me more time to potentially relax. And I don't know, I'm just all over it type of thing. Where back in the office, it would have been hard to concentrate. I would have been having conversations with people because I was distracted. People would be cooking at the kitchen. I'd be like, oh, what are you cooking up? You know, stuff like that. But anyway, let's move on anyway. So, please explain what creating safe and brave spaces means to you and why it's important. Now, we've sort of touched the base on a little bit of that, but please share a bit more on that.
Yeah, so for me, a safe space is where people feel comfortable to interact with each other, where they don't feel, they're not fearful of when they show up in a space that something is going to attack them. And then a brave space is building on that to be able to then explore and express your opinions and your feelings of, I don't know, how things could work better or how, what adaptations you need. The safe space is like that, the hug of, you know, I feel safe here, and then moving into a brave space. And sometimes you need both. But a lot of us come from environments where neither of those things are true. And it's absolutely harrowing that we've spent X amount of years being in environments that just, that aren't safe.
You so sort of look back at it. Oh, sorry, you go, Kev.
So, I mean, I guess it's sort of like, you know, it's a comfortable environment or welcoming environment that's also an encouraging one.
Yeah, so if you think of, I don't know, well, if you can make it, if you're in an environment, like think about the last time you made a mistake and how your manager or your boss responded to that. And if your manager is in a position of going, you've done this wrong and this is horrendous, like the repercussions of those actions are horrendous. The opposite of that is also true. If your manager goes, okay, this happened, why did this happen? What can we do better next time? Like a children's playground.
No, it's actually true. Can I give you an example of something that happened to me not long ago, which sort of talks about that? I had, now the person I deal with some of the work I'm doing, she's really lovely, right? Really lovely person. But I find that sometimes when she's under pressure, she will just not think about what she's saying type of thing. So for example, she might call up and then be very short on the phone, right? Now for, you know, we're talking about RSD, stuff like that. For us, we can be like thinking, what have I done wrong type of thing. And I remember there was an instance where she called me up about something and she was very short about some stuff. And she's like, you need to make sure this and this, and then hung up. And after that, I had to stop everything. I called her up. I said, look, I can't work for the rest of the day. I'm just too frustrated. And this was where, you know, maybe if she had a bit of a better understanding. And it was actually interesting because I called her up and I said, look, why were you talking to me like that? And she's like, what do you have a problem with me, Will? Have you been not? And I'm like, no, I don't have a problem with you at all. I'm actually saying this right now rather than keeping it bottled up. But I just thought maybe if she had some sort of understanding and knowledge about how maybe to approach things, it could have diverted that issue, if that made sense. Because I was really frustrated after that, and it wasn't that I was frustrated at her. I was just like, oh, you know, I just knew it was to do with, you know, especially being neurodivergent and all of that type of stuff, which I can understand because the company that I do some work for, they're not neuro inclusive at all, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I've worked in consultancy for quite a long time, and my first ever gig of being like a client engagement manager, so the person that manages the relationship with the client, as well as doing some work on the ground, this is way before I knew I was neurodivergent. I'd had a conversation with the client and I wasn't managing the relationship properly. One, because I didn't know how to, and two, I had no idea what I was doing, really. And one day someone came in who was a level above me and took the project out of my hands and was like, you're failing. This is what we're going to do. And I was like, what happened?
Yeah, I don't know.
And I don't know whether it was a lack of awareness of when it really started to go wrong, because it would have been weeks beforehand. And I think the awareness of conversation that it's okay to fail, and it's okay to fail in a safe space because you've got a support network around you, because the failure doesn't happen because of one person. There is you're in a company, we're a collection of we're a network together. And so if we fail, there's a missing chink in the armor. It's not one person.
And I also think as well that, say, for example, in your instance, right, if someone had to come to you earlier and said, hey, look, struggling with this, we're struggling with that, let's talk about this, let's find some solutions, it might have been a bit of a better outcome than, okay, you're now off this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah, because yeah. It's a little like, oh, my God, what are they saying behind my back?
Yeah. And also, what did I do wrong? I didn't realize.
Totally. And how are people supposed to grow and develop when you're not giving that feedback or really supporting them, if that makes sense?
And I think also that people don't know how to support them. But people don't necessarily know how to support their colleagues because they don't know about whether it's neuroinclusion or, you know, consultancy's worked in a very similar way for years. So therefore, that's how it's always worked. Therefore, it's acceptable when actually the opposite is true.
It was actually interesting. Just recently, we had to part ways with someone on a project we were working on, a neurodiversity project, mind you. And, you know, this person would come to a meeting and it felt like they were angry. They wouldn't listen to people's ideas. They would, they were just so angry. And or they wouldn't even communicate correctly. And I'm like, that's it. You know, when you're working on a neurodiversity project, you can't bring everything that we're trying to work against to the team and expect us to be able to build something that's not that, if that makes sense. And we just had to tell the person to that we had to part ways because at the end of the day, really, you've got to practice what you preach, if that makes sense. You know, you cannot, if you're trying to build something, you do have to have, you've got to be doing exactly what it is. It's like with us, with this podcast, for example, if we were like not communicating, well, I hope we're communicating all right, but coming across really bad and all that type of stuff, man, we're like going to lose people all the time. Do you know what I mean? You've really got to practice what you preach when you're working with people, especially with neurodiversity, all that type of stuff. Now, talking about that, what have you seen occur in tech when these spaces aren't created? So I think you have touched base a little bit on it, but what's some things you've seen?
Yeah, so going back to a company where I was previously, so I ended up being so poorly out of not just that specific event, but probably stuff that's happened over years and years that I developed an overactive thyroid. And I'm not saying the two things are absolutely connected, but I was so poorly that I had to take 7 months off work. Mm. So stress levels of being, of people not necessarily understanding how to look after their colleagues, seeing me not behaving as expected, I've not understood social norms and it being a catalyst for lots of quite damaging behaviours. And reflecting on those moments, it drove me to create Kind Too, because compounding kindness enables these things to not happen. Like, nobody should feel like a failure for being different.
Yeah, totally. Kev, what have you experienced similar stuff like that, mate?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's on a broken record. We've talked about it a lot before on the podcast, but yeah, just, you know, the job hopping when I was younger, because I wasn't understanding, thinking I'm trying to apply myself. And then I felt a lot in school as well, like failure, but I wasn't the only one failing. The system that was there was failing me to an extent.
But can I also say, it's funny that you talk about job hopping, right? If we talk about, and sorry if I'm going back to like tertiary education or higher education, what I'm finding with a lot of neurodivergent people as well is that it's the same in education. Once they leave school, they will go, oh, I'm going to go do this. And then maybe they've had a bad experience or people haven't understood them. Then they've gone to something else once again. It's almost like the same type of thing happening over and over again, just in different circumstances, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it took a long time and diagnosis for me to realize that, I wasn't a failure. I was just failing to find a system that was accommodating in just a few simple ways, but that I really needed. And then when I found that, that's when everything fell into place. You know, business started to thrive and everything went really well. But yeah, it's a pretty lonely feeling.
Yeah, and also moving around a lot in some scenarios may not be a bad thing. That jobs for life don't exist in the same way as they used to. Things change.
I would go insane. Well, it's true. I need something new. And I think, like, for me, like, business for me works well. And I'm not saying that, or, you know, there's this big, I see a lot of people pushing that, like, neurodivergent people should be start a business and that. Not all neurodivergent people want to be business owners, right? No. But for me, it works well because it's stimulating my brain. I'm able to solve problems. I'm able to try things. There's none of this, oh, no, you can't do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That was the biggest part I struggled with, was because I would be thinking of very different ways to solve problems in the workplace, and then it would be outside of some sort of red tape, and they'd be like, no, you can't do that that way. You have to do it this way. Mm. And just that constant no. And then sort of the perception from a lot of bosses, like, well, you're a failure because you're not fitting the system, and not actually assessing if you might do the job better, or if allowing you to do it a bit more differently might actually be quite efficient. It was just that they view you as a failure for not fitting the cookie cutter more so than about the performance of the work sometimes.
Yeah, and also the efficiency of doing things in a different way, like, it can have some amazing effects. I was speaking to somebody the other day, and I can't remember who made this quote, and I can't remember who it was. Someone said something about who made fire. Like, was it an ADHD person? Like, who first rubbed those sticks together going, oh, what happens if I do this?
Yeah. Do you know what, right? I often think about that, and, like, I did used to have a drug problem, but, like, I often think about how did people know to eat mushrooms and then get a high off it, or how the hell did someone say, hey, look, let's make this and let's taste it and see what happens? Do you know what I mean? Like, how do people, where does that come from? I just don't get that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think since cave people times, there have always been different types of brain. Because I don't know, if you need a lookout person, I'm probably a really good person to do that because I am assessing danger everywhere.
I will keep that in mind if we need a lookout person, hey, and you're in Australia.
I'm thinking more for, like, lions and tigers. I don't really want to look for, is that really the amount of spiders that we get taught over in the UK that are in Australia?
There is, but, like, I think the thing with, and but it's not like, you know, I've been overseas and people are like, oh, snakes, or oh, spiders, and, like, Kev, like, come on, man, seriously, do you see heaps of spiders? Is that a spider behind you there, man?
There's literally a giant web on the steps outside of the window behind the computer.
Yeah, so. But then, like, that's just normal, right?
This is what happens with a lot of Australians. We get complacent, and we don't have a different experience. You know, like, we have far more of that stuff than anyone else. But if I could go on to the different ways of thinking stuff. You know, no great, you know, humanity changing technology ever came out of thinking the same way. Mm. I mean, all innovation comes out of thinking differently. So I'm still a little uncertain as to why it's not more encouraged. Yeah.
But I think we're probably just, you know, I think, but I will say that compared to when I first got into neurodiversity, more people are starting to get on, would you say, the bandwagon or whatever, because they're starting to go, you know, things take time for people to change, if that makes sense.
Mm. Mm.
That's just my experience. What about yours, Georgina?
Yeah, and I think also seeing the benefits as well, like being able to see the benefits of being able to, you know, create those psychologically safe spaces so people go, oh, I've got this idea, or I'm just going to try this, and then you've got, I don't know, the next Google Drive or whatever.
Mm. And I think as well, once people start seeing the flow-on effects by having a psychologically safe space, and they start to go, hang on, that's not just good for neurodivergent people, that's pretty good for everyone. Do you know what I mean? They're like, oh, now I get it.
Yeah. A rising tide lifts all ships. It's not just one.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, you've spoken a little bit about, you know, you do some coaching and stuff like that. Now, what positives would coaches or consultants bring to these environments?
I think it's the outside perspective. So someone, especially someone with lived experience of something, that knows how to create those psychologically safe environments. And also, if someone's worked in your world, it can be really helpful because they'll be able to speak the language you can whilst also bringing that outside perspective. Because when we're in our own worlds, we can get really stuck in doing the same things all the time and then getting frustrated that they don't change, but we're not sure how. So coaches and consultants can become that catalyst for change.
Yeah, totally. You know, some of the hardest things there are some big neurodiversity companies getting out there, right? And which is fantastic, but some of them are being started by people who aren't neurodivergent people. And for me personally, I'm all about encouraging more neurotypical people to learn about neurodiversity and embrace it, and, you know, they'll never know exactly what it's like to be neurodivergent unless you're neurodivergent yourself, right? But sometimes I find with some of, say, like coaches training of people who aren't neurodivergent going into some of these places, they're sometimes doing more damage than good. And I'll give you an example. I went to like something I had to speak at. Then they got this lady to get up who is from some neurodiversity company here in Australia. And then I remember getting up and talking about neurodiversity and what neurodivergent people need and want. And I'm thinking there going, man, that's exactly the opposite. And that doesn't bother me. Do you know what I mean? That's one part of neurodiversity, you know? And the hardest thing for me in that situation was because they were quite a large company, everyone took on her information more than what my information was. And that's what really pissed me off.
I know, remember when we, so Will and I have looked at various times in the background about developing an app around connections and stuff for neurodivergent people. And we had a look at a competitor's app and it wasn't created by neurodivergent people. And you can tell because the list of things that it was trying to address were like a shopping list top 10, you know, most cliche things. And it was quite insulting and patronizing. Yeah.
I started creating an app for neurodivergent people. Yeah, so cool. I've started creating I just thought about it.
Oh, yeah, you just thought about it.
So I've started it. So I've got a test group of people. So basically it's a notes app. So the biggest struggle I have with notes apps is I've got notes everywhere. I've started to create the same book about 15 times. And what I want is a fascia, a facade on that to be able to really simply show me you've tried to do this so many times and it actually lives in here. So then I can go back to my initial brain point and go, it's so cool. So it's a aggregator of notes from different places. It's completely the person's notes. It's not shared with anybody else, but it aggregates people's notes. So then you can see using machine learning, see themes of the stuff that you've done. It's so simple. It's an aggregator of information that you've already got. Showed in a really simple way, like, I don't know, my ADHD top 10 tips that have made my life so much easier. Do you think 62,000 times?
I don't know how many different versions of a watch this movie later list that I have.
Oh, don't. I've got so many.
Scroll down a bit further, you're like, oh, I've got another one there.
Yeah. So what this app does is it aggregates it. So then you've got one very simple thing that says to you, you've put this list together, I'm going to aggregate it, I'm going to make it look pretty and show you the information that you've already got, because object permanence is a massive thing for ADHDers. If it's not in front of me, it doesn't exist. Like if I've got something in a wardrobe, not looked at it for years, whether it's in a suitcase or it's, you know, people around me that I haven't seen for a while, and I look through WhatsApp and I'm like, oh yeah, I really want to speak to that person, and it's not because I've forgotten about them on purposefully. It's that if something isn't in my immediate vision, I forget about it. And what I'm trying to do is bring, and I think the internet can make that a lot harder, when you digitize everything, it's all hidden in a Google Drive. It's all gone.
And imagine trying to explain that to a neurotypical person for them to design the app. It would be, you know, so the fact that you're driving it, I guess this is the point that we're getting to, is it's just going to work much better.
Yeah, because I think there's a thing in a, I don't know, I feel like sometimes there was a rule book of life that I just wasn't given of like things that I should just know exist, like, you know, people exist all the time, or you know, that thing in the wardrobe that you've put in that specific place. I'm like, oh, I don't have that rule book. So I need a strategy to make it exist.
Yeah.
Do you know what's funny, right? Like, I've even got, like, I do that exact same thing. I've got, like, my digital notes and all that type of stuff. And I do refer to it sometimes. But I've even, like, you probably can't see it, but I still refer to, like, post-it notes and all that. You can probably see it on my wall there.
I love post-its and whiteboards.
Well, these ones are actually magnetic ones. Ooh. They don't like stick. They stick, but they're magnetic. So you can just pull them off, put them somewhere else. They work so much better. But sometimes that's the thing.
Into your immediate vision.
And I still love even just having, like, if I had a whiteboard here right now, man, I'd be uncontrollable. You know what I mean? Yeah, totally. I'm in my element. You know what I mean?
The last 60 seconds of this conversation, just us getting excited about post-its on whiteboards, needs to go into a TikTok or something. ADHD people.
Nothing wrong with that. Oh, good. So, you know, we're talking about coaches and consultants and what they can bring to the environment, but how would this benefit consultant, like, your clients type of thing? And Kev, when we spoke about this, we're talking about actual like neurodistinct clients, right? Yeah. So how would that benefit, like, you know, neurodivergent clients? Your environment would have changed. So it's going to be like supporting them in that way. Do you know what I mean? Also, too, the managers are going to have a better understanding, so the people are going to feel a lot more confident. Would you agree?
Okay. Yeah, so I think there are a couple of things. One, from a person perspective, when someone feels safer in an environment, they'll want to – that. When I feel safe in an environment, like, I'm super excited, I share my best work, and I get really involved in something. If I'm the opposite, I'll sit there doodling and going, I'm so stressed and I feel like I'm doing nothing. So it's easier to get the best out of someone when you understand them, whether that's on a one-on-one relationship. So me and my husband have spent the last 2 years really trying to figure each other out, because the better we communicate, the easier it is to be in a relationship with each other. You know, like, being married to someone with ADHD isn't the easiest thing in the world. So the more my husband can understand me and the more I can understand him, the better our relationship is. And a work relationship is obviously not the same as a married relationship, but every relationship we have is based on communication. And when those things work, when you invest in your employee well-being, it's more than just the right thing to do. You also then go into the bottom line stuff of, you know, I read some research a little while ago that found that for every £1, that's British pounds, invested, there's an average return of £5.30. And this is, the more you support your people, the better they're going to work with you. So, I don't know, factor in expenses related to employee turnover, recruitment, training, when you have to pay for people because they're off sick, because they were in an environment that was really, really stressful. Make the environment less stressful, because we're creating really cool things. We don't need that stress. We need like a little bit of excitement and a little bit of fun. But the window of tolerance of, you know, we shouldn't be, do you remember those old kettles, the old teapots that used to
whistle
on the stove? Exactly.
Let's
let it go like this before it whistles and goes everywhere.
Yeah. But it's actually true. You know, I was actually speaking to my wife about it the other day so here in Australia, we have something called the Melbourne Cup, which is like a big horse race, right? Has it been yet? I can't remember. I don't think it's been yet.
No, it hasn't.
But what I was getting at was a lot of the corporate world will have the afternoon off and they'll have like a Melbourne Cup day, or sometimes they just take the whole day off and then just go to a pub and drink or whatever like that, right? Now, I remember working in other certain places. Nah, that stuff would never happen. Do you know what I mean? And I thought to myself, man, little things like that actually would play such a huge role in those little perks with your job type of thing. It makes it a little bit fun. Do you know what I mean? It's not so hardcore, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
Cool. Yeah, work in some regards like isn't the be-all and end-all, but is the be-all and end-all in a lot of our lives. So making the environment safer and braver for people, for me, is more than the right thing to do.
Mm. Yeah, totally, totally. Now, we're getting towards the end there, so we're doing – not many people have come through with questions today. Hey, where's our main man, Martin? He must be not catching the train today. Sorry, for some of our listeners, we always have Martin messaging through while we're going live, but he must be busy today. But what do we have here? So what do you believe are the most important changes to start with if we're going to create these types of environments?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to understand what your baseline is. So where are you at the moment? What understanding do you have? And also recognizing that it's not a bad thing. It's okay to not know something, that we're on a journey to figure stuff out. Like, there's so many things in the world I don't know. Nobody knows everything. So to start from a place of curiosity and kindness as well. When you're learning something new, it's really difficult. When I learned to spend 5 days learning to draw a couple of weeks ago, day one was so intense. I was so stressed because I didn't know what I was doing, and kind of calming myself down to go, okay, be kind to myself. I don't know how to draw, and that's the whole point of me being here. Like, feeling those frustrations and knowing that the more you absorb it and the more you question, the more curious you are, the easier it's going to be.
Yeah. And I think this is the thing, like, and this is the biggest question I get asked a lot is, where do we start? Do you know what I mean? And I think you're right. Just asking questions is probably the best thing to start doing. And I think as well, just even if, you know, if we're I think a big thing as well is people speak about like, oh, I don't know. What do I do if I've got like a neurodivergent person who hasn't opened up to me about being neurodivergent, or what do we do in this case, blah, blah, blah. And it's sort of like, well, just start creating this environment. Do you know what I mean? And even if you're not neurodivergent yourself, just starting those environments and getting people interested can actually do a lot, because other people might start to go, hey, look, I'm neurodivergent. Do you mind if I try and help build this environment or something like that? And once again, that costs nothing.
Yep. And that community as well. So totally. I created a whole course because I was asked that question. That's where Embrace Difference to Create the Incredible came from, because I was asked how do I identify someone? And that question came from such a place of care. It came from a place of, if I can understand how a person behaves or have that label, because labels can be really helpful to kind of get a sense of what's happening. But also it can be quite detrimental if you don't know what to do with the information. So the whole purpose of the workshop is to go from, okay, what questions am I trying to ask myself? Like, why am I doing this? To, oh, okay, if I use simple steps to create a psychologically safe space, then it doesn't necessarily matter, because we're creating that environment. Going back to that rising tide lifts all ships, we're creating that space where people feel safe. Therefore, I don't know, practical things of workplace adjustments to cater for sensory needs. Some people find it really difficult to work in a really busy office. Is there something else we can do? Clearer styles of communication, meeting agendas. If you're going to have a conversation with someone, and give them a heads up, not that 2 p.m. on a Friday going, hey, can I just have 5 minutes? It sends me into absolute overload. Please don't do that. Please at least give someone a little bit of a heads up as to what you're going to talk to them about.
And I think as well, even having like knowing that someone's got your back, and I mean like a manager just coming and talking to you and saying, oh, hey, man, how's everything been going this week? I just thought I'd come and speak to you and see how you've been. You know what I mean? Those little things can go make such a big difference, because maybe you are struggling, and if people can feel comfortable to be open with you, you've done your job as a manager or leader or whatever that is. Do you know what I mean?
Also being kind and patient, because you can, the three of us having a conversation now, and we can see a small window into each other's lives, and taking a step back and being kind when you're having a conversation, because you've got no idea what someone's going through. So please be kind to each other when having a conversation.
And both in and out of, you know, needs in terms of neurodiversity, I think this is just good initiatives to have in the first place. You know, I know for a fact it would help in terms of neurodiversity, because these are the sorts of things I tried. You know, it makes me think back and go, I was trying to communicate exactly the problems that I was having with my neurodiversity to my employer, to other employees, and it was falling on deaf ears. And I was thinking, okay, yeah, if they were educated, you know, that might have gone differently. But then I'm thinking, no, I think some of those considerations are perfectly legitimate for anyone to want, you know. So that's why I think kindness is a good through line with that.
Yeah. You know, but I will say, and it's not an excuse, but I've spoken to people before, and I've spoken, and they're like, this person, and they're not talking about the neurodivergent person, they were actually talking to me about one of the managers who wasn't able to deal with this neurodivergent person, and they're like, this person is under the pump, they're very almost military style type of ways of doing things, and it's like they just need to get results. And it's like, well, okay, I understand they've got they need to get results, but they're going to be losing a lot of, it might not even just be the neurodivergent person they're losing. They're probably losing a hell of a lot of other people, because they don't have any leadership there, or they're not willing to change or learn as well. So sometimes, even if you've got someone who's a high earner or something to your company, they could be doing more damage than good if you're giving them the leeway to be that person.
Particularly, I'm thinking of sales teams in particular.
I was talking the exact same thing, man. Yep, sales can be very bad at that, man, because it's almost like a ruthless environment. You know? But not saying all salespeople are like that. I've met some pretty good salespeople as well.
I mean, you can imagine me, right, when I was very early 20s, maybe late teens, trying to find a job that would suit me as an autistic ADHD kid. And for some reason, someone thought that I should go and try door-to-door sales.
Damn, man.
I either didn't want to talk to anyone that day, or I wanted to talk the person's head off.
crazy. Yeah. Unbelievable. But Georgina, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. Now, if people want to connect with you, find out the work you're doing, where can they best find you?
Yeah, the best place is LinkedIn. So my name is Georgina Shute, and also you can find me online at kind2.co.uk.
Nice, cool. No other social media?
Not yet.
Not yet.
And just for anyone listening who can't see the screen, it's kind to
spell T-W-O.
Hang on, let me, I can take that off the screen. All right, kind two. So, can you read it out, Kev, mate?
KINDTWO.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Photon John, did you have anything else you wanted to say before we finish up, brother?
Good chat, people. Enjoyed this.
Yeah, Georgina, you're all cool.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, what's the temperature like over there at the moment? It's starting to cool down? Like
10 degrees, I think.
10 degrees. Damn, man. 10 degrees would be considered a cold day here in Australia.
Yeah.
Same here. I mean?
Oh, really? Wow. It's going to get a lot cooler right?
Yeah.
Yeah, damn. It's like getting really hot here. But anyway, that's Australia for you. But Georgina, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
For anyone listening, please connect with Georgina. She's doing some amazing stuff, and we really appreciate you coming on the podcast today.
Thank you.
Not a problem.
Have a great day, folks.
Bye. So for anyone else listening, if you haven't already done so, please subscribe, like, and follow to all of our social media platforms, or check us out at the Open Heart and Society podcast. My name's Will Wheeler, joined with my main man, Photon John, and this is the Open Hearted Podcast. Until next time.